Colonel Hollis, drill 4. The Quetta earthquake must have occurred round about the time you were in India. Did you have anything to do with that?
Yes, I think I must say that I was very lucky because I left Quetta the night before the earthquake. It's probably the most devastating earthquake that's ever taken place in that part of the world. In that, the city of Quetta was there at 11 o'clock at night, and there wasn't a brick standing on top of another the following morning. It was completely flattened, and a terrible death roll. Fortunately, the army and the RAF lived above the city, up the hills, and the effect of the earthquake was not so great there. The main line of it went straight through the city, but it did hit the airfield where the RAF were located, and they suffered some casualties. When I got there, there was very bad looting. The local tribesmen came in, and the whole place got completely out of control, and the only way they could stop them was for the police to tie them to trees and flog them in front of their compatriots. Anyone found looting or so on. The whole place was completely out of control for a time. No water, no electric light, nothing. As I say, I left the night before and had returned to Karachi via Hyderabad Sindh. And as soon as the news of the earthquake reached Karachi, emergency operation was launched because it was appreciated that all the English people would have to be evacuated from Quetta, particularly the RAF, and got home. Now, the trouble here was that the staging camp at Karachi was not big enough to cope with an influx of this. Furthermore, the only shipping available to get them down to Bombay so they could get a British liner were the BI boats, which were very small and could not hold very many passengers. So we had once set about reorganizing the staging camp and getting the BI boats re-equipped so as they looked almost like rabbit runs, get in as many people as they could. Thus a cabin which normally held one was divided and partitioned off to hold six, and so on. Well, the influx came down from Quetta once the train got going, because the little station just south of Quetta at Much it was completely destroyed, and it took some time. So these people were in a pretty dreadful state when they arrived at Karachi. And they were put into the staging camp, which they resented at once. And then we managed to get them on the boat, which they disliked even more. But the trouble was that we got them onto the boats at high tide, but when the boat went down below the pier at low tide, the heat was so intense in the boats that they refused to stay on board. And we literally had to mount armed guards to keep them there. Of course, it was the only thing. However, eventually, all speed was made and the evacuation took place. But it was pretty nasty and very unpleasant for those who were being evacuated. Quetta has since been rebuilt, and of course, its importance to us was that it's located just on the edge of Afghanistan, and it also held the staff college. So there was always a large number of military officers up there.
You've already talked a bit about the contact which you had in India with the Indian population in one way or another. Mm. Did you make any Indian friends there? Whom you would meet socially?
Yes, I did. It's really a question of whether you wanted to meet the Indians or whether you didn't, and similarly whether they wanted to meet you or not. But some of us went out of our way to meet them, but they were never really very responsive. You see, there's a question always of if the Indian family had a couple of very attractive daughters. Well, they would not want them falling in love with an Englishman, because they were probably already bespoke to someone else. So, although they were always prepared to meet you, and I came to know one or two whom I liked very much, it never got very far. But that, of course, was in the early 30s. Things have changed since then. I would play tennis at the Indian club, and I would invite an Indian to come and play tennis at the Gymkhana or Sin Club. That was all perfectly accepted. And of course, they were very good tennis players.
Were your Indian friends army people or civilians?
Civilians.
What type of things did they do for a living?
Well, they were businessmen, worked in the bank. There was a good deal of money around Karachi. They'd be shipping people who'd moved up in English firms. They might be landowners, housing owners, anyone. But they were what you would call the high-class Indian, high-class Indian businessmen. You wouldn't go looking anywhere else, because it wouldn't have been the right thing to do. And these Indian families, they were perfectly open about it. If you want to know them, they were prepared to know you, and that was all. But they didn't want you, I think, coming to their houses frequently, any more than we wanted them coming into our houses frequently. It was just an understanding.
Did you ever have meals together?
No. I think that would possibly be because they would not have liked our food, and we certainly wouldn't have liked theirs. So it's mutual again.
Were they of any particular community? Were they Muslims rather than Hindus, or vice versa, or Parsis, or what?
All kinds. The Parsis are, of course, high-grade, really Persians. They hang out in Bombay and Pune. It was a beautiful Parsi girls I meant to mention just now when I said Pune was, I suppose, it's a great center for Parsis. The complexions are much lighter. Girls were very pretty indeed, beautiful, beautiful complexion. No, there were all kinds of sects. One didn't mix with them very much because they had their own religion. The Towers of Silence out in towards Drigue Road, where the Parsis had their dead put on these towers, which was as the hawks could come down and devour them. And when they removed all the flesh, the bones fell through the grill. That was their religion. I did discuss it once jokingly with a Parsi, and he said, well, it's entirely a matter of taste, but I reckon I shall finish up nearer God than you will do underneath the earth. Well, generally, one didn't interfere with the various religions. One knew a Hindu, and one knew a Mohammedan. And one knew that basically, through religion, they were at daggers drawn. But unless something happened, they worked along perfectly all right together. Just as Roman Catholics and Protestants could in Northern Ireland. It's the same story. But if someone starts something, it's trouble.
Did you and the other officers have any personal preferences or any differing attitudes towards one section of the Indian population or another, either with regard to religion or with regard to which part of India they came from, which provinces, or did you regard them all alike?
I think generally we regarded them all alike because our association with them was mainly with the Indian Army, and these were Indian Army regiments. They could be Sikhs, or they could be Punjabis, or Gurkhas, and one took them as such. The smart Sikh soldier with his beard and hair all tied up in a knot was one chap. A clean-shaven Punjabi was another. Little Gurkhas who need no description was another. Everyone understood each other but didn't meddle. I don't think we tried to get to know, or some people did. I think particularly missionaries and so on. And my own opinion is that they usually caused more trouble than the good they did.
Did these Sindhis, the population in the area in which you mostly stayed, have any particular characteristics to distinguish them from other sections?
They were very dark, which is natural living in the Sindh Desert. No, they were just a tribe. See, India's a mass of tribes. It's all tribes and clans. Thus, around Karachi, there'd be the state of Les Bila. Immediately above that was the Khan of Kalat with his lot. And then there'd be Sindhis. But they were all, if not intermarried, intermerged. It isn't till you go some way distant and say, if you got up into Kashmir there and the Afridis, they're much fairer skin, blue-eyed, and can have almost blonde hair. Otherwise, you could usually tell what type of Indian you were talking to. If you, I mean, you could say, there's a Sikh, he's a Punjabi, that's a Mohammedan, Muslim.
Just from looking at them?
Just by looking at them.
Did you go into the local towns very much? On any places, did you go out of the cantonment to go into Karachi City or Hyderabad City very much to see the local towns?
Well, Hyderabad was only a tiny little town, village, with a lot of ancient forts around it. One went through, and the locals were fully used to seeing either soldiers in uniform or in civilian clothes walking about the place. Want to go down to the bazaar and see if there are any bargains to be had. Karachi City, which was a big city, one kept more or less out of it, but one had to go down to the banks to get your money, draw the battalion's pay once a week. One had to go through it to get down to the harbour. One didn't go into the back streets unless one was after something particular, because one might not have been popular. You never know, one might have been very popular. But the best way to keep out of trouble is not to invite trouble.
Did you ever feel ill at ease in any of the Indian towns?
No, never.
What was the demeanour of the people in the towns towards a British officer walking about?
Ignore him completely, because he had no business with him. And as I say, if you went past a shop and something, they would be out like a shot trying to sell you something. But unless there was business to be done, they merely ignored them. And the streets, the pavements, weren't particularly best places for an English person to go walking, because the clerks working up in above the street had this particularly revolting habit of chewing betel nut and then spitting it out of the window. So you're quite likely to find that you've suddenly got a flash of red betel nut juice down your shirt. So better to keep out of the way.
Did you buy anything in particular in India to bring home?
No. I don't think I ever bought anything to bring home, because unless you were an expert, you would be buying brass articles, which it was almost 100 to 1 were manufactured in Birmingham. Carpets, if you could get them, were a very good buy. And it might be interesting to describe how the patterns from some of these carpets are done. These very beautiful Indian carpets and Persian carpets, the pattern is usually done by a tune. Thus, the song is sung, and as the man who knows the song sings it, so the wools are put in accordance with the words he said, and that song will produce a pattern. Now, many of these carpets, good carpets, are made in the Indian prisons. So, of course, it's essential to arrest locals who know the song of a particular tune. But I've watched them doing this, and it's quite fascinating.
You watch them in the prisons?
Yeah. You get to know a local inspector and say, can you have a look round? And he'll show you around, a chap sitting in the condemned cell with a little caplet on them. They're going to be strung up in the near future, but the inmates don't know it. And you go around, and I'm showing this carpet making do. And of course, a chap who knows several songs is quite a valuable fella.
Your police guy didn't tell you that they'd arrest him just because of that, did he?
No, but it was pretty obvious.
Did you take much interest in Indian arts and customs, like the architecture, or did you go around temples or the Taj Mahal or anything of that kind?
No. I think the historical side was very interesting, and of course, if you were ever in the area where the mutiny had taken place, one was always interested in it. But again, as I say, unfortunately, being in Karachi the whole time, there was no Eastern mysticism to be seen. One was in a modern town. But when one was out shooting or up at Hyderabad, I'd examine the forts, the old forts. The extraordinary thing which always strikes me is how the British soldier managed to fight these battles dressed in full scarlet uniform in a temperature of 120 degrees. How he managed to exist, let alone fight, but he did and fought very well.
Did you enjoy your time in soldiering in India, or were you glad to leave?
I would say they were the 5 of the best years of my life, and I would always, had British Raj been there, would have advised anyone to go out to India. You led an extremely healthy life. There was a variety of things to do, and innumerable friends to be made, and time went all too quickly. One worked hard and truthfully and played hard. The days hadn't got enough hours in them. One left the dance at 2 o'clock in the morning and were on parade at 7.
Whilst you were an officer in the army in India, did you and the other officers at that time, in the 30s, always consider it perfectly natural that the British Army should be there in this foreign country, or did it ever strike you as being odd?
No, I would say that I was too young to worry about that, but I was fully aware, with the trends of the thing in the world, that this situation might not continue. But there didn't seem to be any much thought of at the time until Gandhi started. And then there were the first beginnings of Congress and dissatisfaction. And one could then see that something was going to happen. But the army was there. The country was prosperous, and it seemed unlikely that anyone would be stupid enough to break the British Raj at that time. But then World War II wasn't in the offing. Had World War II been in the offing, then one might have thought differently.
Were these stirrings, political stirrings, to which you've referred, evident to you solely through the newspapers, or did you see any evidence of it in actual life yourself?
Oh, there was more evidence in actual life than there was in the papers. See, the Gundley chaps, sympathisers, all wore these peculiar white hats, and as it came on the increase, it was quite clear that they were anti the British Raj, and this began to produce the first difference of feeling between the Commoner Guard and British soldier and his Indian friend.
Did they show that to you as a British Army officer at all, that hostility?
Not aggressively, but the fact that they were wearing a Gundy hat was well, much as saying, I'm a Congress waller, and you know what we're going to do. But there was nothing aggressive, although Gundy himself and his followers were over in eastern India beginning to start uprisings and so on, civil disobedience. You'll remember I quoted Master's book, Bawali Junction. We saw civil disobedience there. That was just about when it was coming along.
Did you see any evidence of that type of thing yourself, civil disobedience?
No, not at the time, because I had left India in 1935. The beginnings were there for anyone to see, but like all these things, one wasn't taking it all that seriously. But it was quite obvious that it was coming along, because I mentioned that there was a plan then in Karachi that Indians should be invited to join the white clubs and so on, and there was to be a greater fraternizing between the two. This was the higher-ups thinking ahead. One saw the glimmer of this coming, but I'd gone. I'd had my bite of India at the right time.
And did you see any evidence of political activity by Indians at all whilst you were there, apart from the wearing of these Gandhi caps?
No, not in the part of India that I was in.
No demonstration?
No demonstration. One was aware that there was something in the air, but what it was, I suppose one really in one's youth said, well, it's none of our business. Let them get on with it.
What was the attitude of the officers towards Congress and towards Gandhi, if any?
Well, very anti, because you've got to remember, and this is where some people made a very grave mistake later on with the partition of India, that the Mohammedan was our traditional friend. Congress were mainly Hindus, and they were not our traditional friends. And this is where, in 1945, I think a very grave mistake was made.
What mistake are you referring to?
Well, I think the mistake they made, as we saw it, was that the British politicians seemed to favour the Congress side when doing the partition of India, as opposed to the Mohammedan side, which was going to become Pakistan. I don't think they appreciated that a Mohammedan in India is of the same faith as a Mohammedan in Persia, Kuwait, or North Africa. And thus, by showing favour to the Congress side, it made these Mohammedans think twice about their friendship to Great Britain. And when the partition was completed, it wasn't long before we were being kicked out of practically every Mohammedan country throughout the Middle East and North Africa, with disastrous results of our oil interests in those countries. And I shall always maintain that had we shown a little more favour towards the Mohammedans and the future Pakistan, and a little less to the Congress, this would not have happened.
Whilst you were a soldier in India in the first half of the 30s, were you and the other officers aware of the existence of the Muslim League and its leader, Jinnah, or not?
Yes. Well, there's always been, for years and years, the two sides, Hindu and Mohammedan. And given the opportunity, they'll tear each other to bits. Various rulers, Jinnah, had sponsored the Mohammedan element, and other leaders such as Gandhi, Mr. Patel, Nehru, had encouraged the Hindu element to increase its influence. And thus must always be the two. And as I said earlier, the Irish situation that we've got at the moment is so similar.